This interview with Jamie Hubbard and Paul Swanson took place in November 2018 during the AAR annual meeting in Denver, Colorado. It consists of 8 segments. Here they first provide an overview of what is known as critical Buddhism and discuss their book, Pruning the Bodhi Tree, a work on that very topic. Next, they discuss the views of Hakamaya Noriaki and Matsumoto Shiro and go on to explain Buddha nature in the Tentai tradition, as well as the issue of Buddha nature and practice in East Asian Buddhist traditions more broadly. In the concluding segment, they attempt to define Buddha nature.
I think critical Buddhism, in a narrow sense, refers to the work of Hakamaya Noriaki and Matsumoto Shiro, two professors at Komazawa University who in the late 1980s, early 1990s, published a series of very polemical articles saying Tathagatagarbha idea is not Buddhism, or, you know, original enlightenment is not Buddhism, Buddha nature is not Buddhism.
Zen is not Buddhism.
Zen is not Buddhism. and the reasoning for that was reacting to the Japanese situation, I think, and the history of Japanese Buddhism, in which the idea of original enlightenment or everyone is enlightened just became standard, unchallenged assumption. Then it kind of spread from there. A lot of Western scholars picked up on what they were saying and developed in their own way. People like Dan Lusthaus, he thought, oh, this is what I've been trying to say with my studies with Yogacara. Other people kind of, I think, like the idea of the controversial Zen is not Buddhism type idea, or that, you know, it kind of gave him a handle to criticize kind of unspoken assumptions in American or European Buddhism.
You know, for me too, the context is important for me, and there's a lot of, it's very interesting to me, the context. So kind of like you just said about Dan Lusthaus, for myself, when I arrived at Madison to do my graduate work, back in those days, Madison was pretty much the place to go. And, you know, my own trajectory of involvement in things Buddhist and Buddhist studies, you know, from Japan and kind of a Zen world on through and ending up in Dharamsala and kind of a Gelugpa way of looking at things, you know, I was really attracted to all of that. And then I ran into Kalupa Hana through one of our graduate students, Rodney Horikawa. And, you know, Kalupa Hana had a very strident, polemical view about Buddhism and what it really was, and certainly what it wasn't. And it certainly wasn't anything, or it wasn't a whole lot of what the Mahayana was about. And Wisconsin, you know, I made a couple of notes about this kind of Wisconsin context. And so, you know, at the University of Wisconsin, when I got there, Buddha nature was an extremely common topic. It was so common that you could guarantee that it would be a prelim question. We had these 3-ring binders of prelim questions that we would pass around, you know, like the kirigami, you know, the secret lore. And there were like, so we had like 20 different answers on, is Buddha nature the same as Atman, Hindu Atman, right? Another one was, is bhakti the same as Pure Land? There were a lot of standard questions, right? And so it was definitely, you know, it was in the air. And the group at Wisconsin at that time, you know, this was not a... anywhere, I don't think you could have made it at Wisconsin. This was not an ineffable, mystical way of understanding Buddhism. The people that were there, the people we studied with, Keith Yandell was a professor of the philosophy of religion, and he was a hardcore Anglo-analytic kind of philosopher. You had to be able to say things and defend them. And the other people, Paul Griffiths, who was there, was another philosophical thinker, and he was there. And he went on, and his apologetics is also very much along these kinds of lines. And Jose, writing about scholasticism, the idea that scholasticism is a category of Buddhism was anathema to a whole lot of Buddhists at the time, who thought that the point of Buddhism was to rid your mind of all thoughts and thinking was the enemy and all of this kind of stuff. And other folks too, you know, Roger Jackson, who went on later with John McCransky and did sort of an engage, I don't know, what did they call it, constructive Buddhism, right? And at the same time, you know, theory and criticism was also in the air in the academy in general. You know, the idea that we weren't just objective scholars studying something, and especially if we were Buddhist, if we had Buddhist commitments and we were academics, all of these things were now sort of allowed in the air, and kind of the postmodern denial of objectivity. You know, the idea that there was some scientific thing that we were studying there, and the fact that the academy was political. You know, Foucault and power and these things were not, we weren't innocent out there. And so critical Buddhism shares this, very strongly shares this idea that we are not innocents and that we are smuggling our metaphysical commitments in our supposed academic things. You know, Hakamai's, one of my favorite rants of his was, you know, I go to a conference and I hold up my Xerox copies of Sanskrit manuscripts and everybody thinks I'm a god. But when I go up there and I tell them what I actually think and believe, they call it demagoguery, you know? And that was a very kind of strong statement. And so critical Buddhism shares this kind of distrust of the pretense of the objective scholar with a lot of that. And, you know, other kinds of contexts of it. At the time, Ronald Reagan was the president. Nakasone in Japan was the president, and fears of the resurgence of Japanese right-wing stuff was very much in the air, just as the religious right was a concern over here. And again, they were afraid of, again, in Japan, this was the time of Aum Shinrikyo, you know, the Aum sarin gas bombing stuff, right? So they were very much afraid of the authoritarian possibilities of a non-critical, ineffable, you can't say anything about it, understanding of what truth was. To them, that leads to the authoritarianism that cannot be criticized and has to be just guru worshipped and can lead to all sorts of complicated stuff, you know, authoritarianism. And so all of those things kind of came together. And when I think of the cohort at Wisconsin at that time, I mean, everybody that came out of that kind of shares that sort of critical stance, regardless of...
was a fortuitous coming together of a number of people. Jamie and I were graduate students. And Hakamaya came to Wisconsin from Komazawa University on a one-year sabbatical. And
Takasaki was there too.
Yeah,
right?
Takasaki came. And he offered to do a course. And we got together once a week to compare the Chinese, Sanskrit, Tibetan, and all the commentaries of the Mahayana Samgraha, the chapter 10, right? And so it was a mix of people, Prographis, John Keenan, Jamie and I, Hanshin from Taiwan. Did you ever?
Come on, okay. You were at Sarah at the time.
Yeah. And... you know, it was the first time for me to have that kind of spread of, and it was a very detailed textual analysis and comparison of across different languages. So the seminar itself was very technical and textual oriented. But the most fun was after the seminar, we'd go out and, you know, for tacos and beer, and for 2-3 hours argue about, you know, Buddha nature and all these other things. And Hakamaya, I think that he was just developing these sort of critical ideas. And as soon as he went back to Japan, he started publishing all these very polemical things. And I think before that, he was kind of afraid to come out and say, well, Zen is not Buddhism, or Tathagatagarbha is not Buddhism. But then, it was... bam, all of a sudden it was out there.
There was a fearful conference at Wisconsin, and Takasaki, Kyoto ran this conference, all these Japanese scholars and Western scholars, and there was one session that went till 3 or 4 in the morning, and it was screaming and filled with tears, and Hakamaya, as a junior kind of guy at that time, was raked over the coals by Takasaki and Nagao and all these, like, these big shots. And at the same time this was going on, largely through the Nanzan Institute folks, Jim Heisig and some of the other folks, books were starting to come out in Japan. This was the beginning of Zen at War, Brian Victoria's Zen at War, and from Nanzan, Rude Awakenings, you know, Buddhism and the War. And there was, so it was starting to come out at that same time about the Japanese just call it the establishment, you call it the Buddhist, the religious establishment. But
Bob Scharf's Zen and nationalism.
Zen and Japanese and the art of nationalism. So, the criticism of the Japanese Buddhist establishment's involvement in ultranationalism and militarism, along with, as I said, Nakasone, and this is called Nihonjinron, the theory of Japanese uniqueness, was all starting to get people a little bit freaked out about, you know, what this was about. And so, you know, if the waving the papers and demagoguery is my favorite Hakamaya quote, I think my favorite Matsumoto quote is, you know, we Japanese aren't just sitting around staring mystically vacant-eyed at flowers and rock gardens all day. We Japanese Buddhists think about stuff, just like you do. And so, you know, the idea that Buddhism was not just this kind of anti-intellectual vacating the mind, tied in with social ideas about authoritarianism and the emerging story of Japanese Buddhist establishment's role in social discrimination, militarism, and things like that. And it kind of all coalesced, you know, interesting.
Yeah, and how words and concepts are important. It's not just, you know, sitting and, right, you said, like emptying your mind and denying, denying the value of texts as ideas or words. Matsumoto's articles kind of exploded on the scene in Japanese Buddhist studies. They started presenting these papers about how Tathagatagarbha is not real Buddhism. And I got an invitation from Cambridge to a workshop with Carmen Blacker, and the theme was rethinking Japanese religion. And I thought, oh, here's a chance to... And I, you know, spent the time going through Hakamai Matsumoto's work, and I gave the paper, and then I published the results in my article called Zen is Not Buddhism, in quotes. But still people tell me, why do you say Zen is not Buddhism? And that led to a broader publication. Jamie and I decided to do a broader book, which became Pruning the Bodhi Tree. And...
There's not much left on the Bodhi tree when the pruning is finished. Because, you know, from their point of view, Buddhism is thoroughly infected with this heresy called Maha Atman, or Dhatuvada, they called it. But the point
and
was...
So the cover is by Frederick Frank, who's quite a famous artist. And he was very upset with the critical Buddhist ideas, so he kind of made this illustration of this denuded tree with only two, you know, emptiness and pratyasamutpada is all that's left. But there's a moon in the background, and that's because of the famous Zen saying. Of the finger pointing at the moon, you know, you shouldn't get stuck with the finger. You have to focus on the moon of enlightenment that the finger points to. But we had a working title for the book based on this idea. And because Hakamaya is so polemical and he attacks people by name and he tells them, you're stupid to believe that. And it was unheard of in Japanese scholarship. So our working title was Promise Them the Moon, But Give Them the Finger.
Because from their point of view, you know, the finger, so the teachings and awakening, right? You know, like leave, don't take the raft over to the other shore and then leave the raft behind. But their point was that the teachings are important. You know, if the words point to... the ground, that's where you're going to end up. You know, so the teachings are extremely important. So, yeah, promise them the moon. You know, give them the promise of awakening. But give them the finger, which fit kind of the humor. And then the other one was, you know, I was saying earlier, this caused a lot of problems. To me, it was very interesting, because for me, their story, I kind of felt like before the book was finished, that I already knew what everybody's responses was going to be. Now, if you're Nyingma, you're going to be like this. If you're Zen, you're going to be like this. You know, if you're Kalupahana, you're going to be like that. And it kind of played out that way, you know, which is an interesting comment on our ability to think critically and change our minds about stuff. But a very senior scholar, Stanley, at least say names, right? You can edit. Stanley Weinstein at Yale, who was very respectful of the Japanese establishment that was being lambasted by Hakamaya, you know, stood up at a conference, at an AAR conference, I forget where it was, and said, if critical Buddhism critical Buddhism is a movement, it's the kind of movement that should be flushed down the toilet. but that's kind of an, you know, both of these stories kind of tell a little bit about the way it all kind of played out. You know, people got upset about this. You know, it was not just an academic argument. Bernard Faure called it a tempest in a teapot, and he was very dismissive of it all for his own reasons. But anyway, so it was interesting along all those ways.
But it's interesting how, like Bernard Faure has some very critical work on Japanese and Chinese Buddhism, and yet he was not very happy about critical Buddhism. On the other hand, people like I'm getting old. Bob Sharpe, who was also an early critique of Japanese Buddhism, you know, Zen and nationalism and such. He's been very positive about critical Buddhism, and I think he's well aware of how it's a repeat, in a sense, of many debates that go on through the whole history of East Asian Buddhism. It's not new in that sense. I think what Hakamai and Matsumoto are saying is you have to be careful with this concept of Buddha nature. It's not simply something that's there or that you're already enlightened. The idea that if you're already enlightened, you don't have to do anything anymore because everything is okay just as you are. You can't accept that uncritically. And I think this theme, I mean, it came out in the Japanese context, but it's been gotten a lot of attention and is still debated in Korea and Taiwan and China because it's recognized as an important question in the field.
I think that's why, you know, if you look at the articles in the book, I don't know what the percentage is, but a lot of it is not about Japan. You know, so people were talking about it, you know, in very heavy-duty philological terms. You know, the argument between Yamabe and Matsumoto, for example, that's carried out at a very sophisticated philological, textual, classical Buddhist, Buddhological kind of level. But people were talking about it, you know, all throughout the Buddhist world. This has been historically, and I think today remains a live issue for people. And so I think that's another reason for the resonance.
I think in one of my papers, I talk about four different levels that they're operating at. One is theological, in the sense that they're both involved in the Soto school. They're professors at Komazawa University. And they didn't like the idea that the Soto school teaches what they thought was a mistaken interpretation of Buddha nature. And there's the social criticism aspect. Hakamaya is one of his earliest, or maybe even his earliest paper on this subject was a paper given at the invitation of the the Center for I don't want to use an inappropriate term. A segment of Japanese society that's been the focus of discrimination, and Hakamaya felt that an mistaken idea of Buddha nature and of people already being enlightened contributed to that sort of social discrimination being accepted, not changed, but, you know, accepted. And there's the Buddhological aspect, which is very technical, textual, discussions over what the term has meant over the years.
I mean, I think when you have a doctrine that says that the core important thing is that reality, with a capital R, is Maha Atman, and is bliss, and is eternity, right? These, you know, the three marks of existence, you know, okay, well, what just happened to the three marks of existence, you know? And so this doctrine, you know, you have to do a lot of hermeneutical gymnastics to make a doctrine which says the real reality is not Atman, but Maha Atman. How do you get to Maha Atman from Anatman? You know, you need to do some stuff. And the history that we've all been studying, and the doctrines and the texts and the commentators have, I mean, because this is all Buddha Vachana, supposedly, right? The word of the Buddha. But you have to do some work to get to the point where, and so the arguments about, is it a teaching in need of interpretation or not? And so I think, you know, Buddha logically speaking, this real simple issue is, if it looks like Atman, smells like Atman, tastes like Atman, and has social political ramifications like Atman,
if it quacks like a duck, it's a duck.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that, you know, and then within this particular kind of social political context of the social discrimination and the militarism and what was going on in Japan, and especially authoritarianism, you know, the idea that, you know, this lends itself to, but also, you know, from their point of view, you know, again, the Buddha, you know, They're not separable. The Buddha logical is, so from their point of view, if true reality is ashunya, right? You know, it's bereft of all of the messy stuff that we're involved in, suffering, war, poverty, racism, sexism, you know, then the messy stuff, yeah, we don't have to worry about it so much. And from their point of view, the beauty of Anatman and Paticchasamutpada is that precisely unlike the Brahmanical traditions that it comes from, this stuff is not Maya and ignorable or not worry about, we don't have to worry about it. This stuff is validated. This is real. You know, the messy stuff is real. And you lose that when reality with a capital R is timeless and untouchable and impermeable and doesn't change and is always perfect and luminous. So I think that's the real thing, is that Maha Atman ain't emptiness, ain't Anatman.
So I have a question about, you were saying earlier that this is a debate that's happened before. This is not a new sort of a rejection of the presence, maybe a rejection of something. So what did they reject? What did they keep? And did they see themselves as a corrective? Did they see themselves as saying, okay, well, we can keep Buddha nature, but we need to interpret it? Or did they just say a whole scale cutting, rejecting, and moving on to some new purified Buddhism that will...
They meaning Hakamaya
and Matsumoto.
Yeah, they talk about returning to real Buddhism or pure Buddhism.
By which they mean?
It's almost like Hinayana Buddhism, right? I mean, to use the
Matsumoto reduces. That's why there's the two fruits left on the Bodhi tree. He kind of reduces everything to emptiness and Paticchasamutpada, and anything that smells of a dhatu is an Atman dhatu it can't be accepted. So that's the real position of Buddhism.
And what about the rest of the Mahayana path?
Mm.
Right.
Compassion. Contra.
Good question.
Well, you know, they're being doctrinal about this, but they're really kind of philosophical. So people oftentimes accuse them, and in the volume you see it, accuse them of being fundamentalist, you know, looking for the true Buddhism, right, as like back looking for the historical Jesus kind of stuff, right? And they criticize them for that. I mean, again, this is the postmodern moment. We don't need to worry about if we could even find if we had a video recording of what the Buddha said. But they weren't really interested in that, you know. Matsumoto, again, I'm kind of famously, infamously said, even if we discover that the Buddha himself said Buddha nature is the true reality, we have to say he was wrong. You know, so it's a philosophical. It's not a historically fundamentalist. It's a philosophically fundamentalist kind of point of view. And so, you know, the question of Tantra doesn't come up. Compassion comes up a lot, you know, and so in other things, particularly both of them also have written about the Pure Land Buddhist schools, the founders of Pure Land, Shinran and Honen. Both of them wrote on those followers too. So, you know, they did branch out, but Tantra, as far as I know, Tantra didn't come in, and they never really framed it in terms of Mahayana and Triyana kinds of things. It was more, what's left is Pratichasamutpada and maybe Pratichasamutpada.
So they don't write, as far as I know, they haven't written specifically about what sort of practices then they would. I assume that they accept the various practices within their tradition, you know, keeping the moral, living a moral life, and other Mahayana practices. Hakamaya is an ordained priest of the Soto school. I think that's why it could never turn into a kind of a new Buddhist school. You know, it doesn't provide the practice side. It remains a philosophical critique, I think.
So, what irked the Japanese establishment more? Was it the doctrinal rejection of Buddha nature and the idea that there is some kind of positive self? Or was it the fact that these people, was it the kind of the nature of the rhetoric itself, which was challenging orthodoxy?
Well, I think it's both. I mean, I've heard people say to me that, well, if you accept what they say, then all of Japanese Buddhism is not Buddhism. So, you know, what's, and that's, of course, not very popular. But it was also the rhetoric. They're very, I don't know, forthright and unusually critical. Usually in Japanese debates, you know, you say, well, yeah, I suppose you're right, but, you know, it's not like, no, you're wrong. So, yeah, that sort of attitude. And also, I mean, it's very hierarchical in Japan. You know, you're supposed to be, you know, pay respects to your sensei. You know,
harmony is to be valued.
And they were criticizing Takasaki and Nagao and these, you know, the top tier of Japanese Buddhist scholars. And
I think also, you know, the social side of it, because as I said, this was in the context both wider but also within the Japanese Buddhist world, and you know they're rubbing the nose, they're rubbing the establishment nose right in it. You know, not only is this not Buddhism, but you know you guys were warmongers, and we have records, and there's probably reparations to be paid, and you know your grandmother's grave in that temple, which proved that you are a Korean and therefore part of the outcast community, you know, and this was the temple that was, so they rubbed people's faces in it. And again, in a very non-Japanese way, you know, they were not conforming to the proper ways of, you know, harmony, the rules. They were breaking all the rules of harmony. But again, it had real implications. And I remember, again, Hakamaya, I mean, he had a lot of fun lines, but they wouldn't let him actually resign his position in the Soto Zen school and say, ah, I told you, Jamie, it's just like the mafia. The only way out is in a pine box. and that was kind of his opinion about the way about the kind of closure of the Japanese establishment Buddhist world. So, you know, they were ruffling a lot of feathers in real terms. I think even more than philosophical. I'm not so sure too many Japanese people outside of some very rarefied university, you know, University of Tokyo and Kyoto, could even follow the argument, frankly speaking.
And there's one article where Hakamaya talks specifically about the Japanese concept of wa, which is supposed to be one of the great virtues of Japanese society, of harmony and getting along with everyone. And he says, well, wa, that can be a very restricting, forceful conformity. You know, so he's criticizing the Japanese social system of forced conformity, which can again lead to the kind of authoritarianism and what he saw and many people see as the pre-war situation, which led to the World War, and he saw aspects of that coming out again. You mentioned Nakasone and kind of a return, you know, this kind of a romantic return to kind of let's make Japan great again by, you know, everyone conforming to.
And don't critically question authority.
So that was part of their critique, you know, whether that fits with, you know, the idea of Buddha nature or not is another question. But
have there been any long-term repercussions of this? I mean, is it nowadays? Do people still look back upon this as a historical intellectual curiosity, a blip that kind of just went away, or has it had any long-term repercussions?
I mean, there was a, you know, it got a lot of attention for a while, and that kind of tempest has passed, but it's still going on. It hasn't disappeared, and you see it a lot where people give papers, and it's not, they're not representing critical Buddhism necessarily, but they can't say anything about Buddha nature or the Nirvana Sutta or whatever without kind of touch. Well, you know, of course, Akamaya and them have pointed out that there are problems with this, but, you know, and I mentioned earlier, you know, a paper that I heard of someone critiquing the Honganji social activity based on what, you know, critical Buddhism. So it's here and there still, but it's not a movement in the sense that, you know, there's a core group of people who are continuing to make this critique. In fact, about 10 years ago, it was inevitable because Hakamai and Matsumoto are both very strong in their opinions, but they finally reached a point where Matsumoto gave a paper and said, I'm announcing my divorce from Hakamai and going my own way, and this is what I think. And so, you know, it's not a cohesive movement in the sense of a core group of continuing their kind of critique.
In that sense, you know, kind of that the furor has passed and the controversy in a big way has passed. However, as Paul was saying, I think that now in and around lots of other critiques, you know, sort of social, political, historical critiques about the Japanese establishment's involvement with this, that, and the other thing, I think nobody can talk about these things anymore without, you know, knowing that in fact it's not all a beautiful, harmonious situation out there, and that Japan, the Japanese Buddhist establishment, does have these kinds of roles, and so they go back to doctrinal issues as well. And so, you know, you can no longer talk about some pristine. Oh, this is good because it goes great to Shentong Rentong. Yeah, you can't talk about some pristine Japanese Buddhist reality that exists outside of the very messy, real Japanese Buddhist establishment that involves Buddhists with bodies. And these Buddhists with bodies have these ideas, and these, you know, their metaphysical presuppositions inform their ethical, personally, individually, as well as in terms of denomination, their activity in the world. And I think nowadays, nobody in Japan can talk about Buddhism in a kind of D.T. Suzuki orientalist sort of fashion anymore, ignoring the social realities as though there's some pristine thing that's Zen and pure and perfect that exists somehow differently. I don't think that conversation can happen anymore. I think they're past that. So in that sense, it's not a furor and a controversy anymore, but I don't think, as Paul said, you can't ignore these when
they've
you talk about it.
They've lost their innocence.
What did you see your own position vis-a-vis this debate to be? Were you drawn to the position of the critical Buddhists personally? Did you find this salutary, interesting? Or did you see yourself more in the position of kind of distanced chroniclers of this debate?
Well, I'm not a Buddhist, so I can't say I was, you know, threatened by what they said. You know, and because I wrote this article with titled Zen is not Buddhism, I'm often asked, well, you know, how can you say Zen is not Buddhism? I say, well, that's not really what I think. I think Zen is Buddhism in the sense that Mormons are Christian. But within the tradition, you can make those sort of kind of value judgments. But as an objective scholar, I was stimulated very much by their thinking and admire many of the, you know, points they make. It was never a question of, do I accept their, controversial statements? In that sense, no, I don't. I tried to, when I wrote my article, I tried to explain what Hakamai and Matsumoto were saying without myself making a personal commitment to it. So,
So I was personally committed to it. It's kind of complicated, I became interested in Buddhism long time ago, and I come from a very strongly Catholic family, and including an older brother who's a philosophy professor at a Catholic university. And again, back in those days, and my earlier introduction in the 60s, in high school and stuff, was a kind of romantic orientalist D.T. Suzuki version of Zen, which is ineffable beyond all of these kinds of things. And so when I encountered the Tibetan, the Gelug tradition in particular in Dharamsala and spent a year studying there, I was really excited because I can go back and I can tell my brother that Buddhism is really hardcore analytic philosophy, man, and it's more logical than thou. Let me assure you, I'm going to beat your ass in this next debate, The Catholics are going to lose. So I was very excited to discover that Buddhism, that's what attracted me to Buddhism. I thought Buddhism was true. Right now we have the neuroscientists, why Buddhism is true, right? But back then, I thought it was, it made sense to me. It made more sense to me than anything else. I had been an education major and a psychology major and a philosophy major, and this one worked for me. So but I still didn't quite understand the stuff, the Zen stuff and the mystical stuff and all of the stuff that I had seen in Japan. So when I got to Wisconsin and this stuff kind of percolated up, it totally resonated with me because, to my mind also, the idea, the genius of the denial of Atman was the affirmation of this world and our need to practice in this world and to help real living sentient beings who are having real life suffering. And I wanted something that affirmed that. And when I didn't like mystical, ineffable stuff because I want to talk, right? So it didn't make sense to me. And we had a lot of that at Wisconsin, as I was saying earlier, whether it was the cohort of people who were all critical thinking people or the faculty that we had. Stephen Beyer was a brilliant faculty guy, Geshe Sopa. So they all sort of... It went along with me. It resonated with me. So when this thing came along, it resonated with me, as a Buddhist and as an academic. It's a little bit more complicated than that. I'm kind of happy that Japanese Buddhism isn't Buddhism. I like it better that way. But that has nothing to do with Buddha nature.
what was the influence of Hakamai on you then?
This was a little bit before. I want to say that Hakamai actually got juiced by Paul Griffiths. I think it was Paul Griffith's critical attitude about stuff that just didn't make sense and he couldn't accept because it was philosophically stupid in his opinion, and he was very sharp about saying that. I mean, his break with Geshe Sopa was a big thing, and so I think that Hakamai was prodded and pushed by Paul Griffith's critical attitude, and then he kind of went over the top on it. Yeah.
My focus is on Juri Diantai of 6th century China. And his analysis of Buddha nature And Buddha nature became very important in the later Tendai tradition. And it appears in Juri's work in the 6th century, but it doesn't have the central kind of focus on that term that it takes on in the later tradition. But he, like with most terms, he gives a threefold analysis of it. There's Buddha nature as the way things are. There's Buddha nature as the wisdom of awareness. And there's Buddha wisdom as the practice which leads to the wisdom which sees reality as it is. And without those three factors, the Buddha nature, you can't talk about Buddha nature without those three aspects. So if you have Buddha nature without the practice, I mean, it doesn't make sense. So that's where the practice comes in, I think. And I like that formulation. It provides a way to understand Buddha nature without making it a kind of something that exists inside. It's a potential, but it's a potential that has to be realized through specific practices. And so,
why don't you say just a couple of sentences about what Tendai is? What is Tendai? What is Tendai for people who may not know? Just to contextualize, okay. Juri and this theory.
Okay, Tendai Buddhism is based on the work of the 6th century Chinese monk Juri, who tried to. It's a kind of Catholic Buddhism. It tried to incorporate all the Buddhist teachings and practices so far that had come into China. There's so many different practices and teachings and seem contradictory. And he made this comprehensive system of practice and doctrine, which was kind of based on the Lotus Sutra's idea of Ho of Upaya and Ekayana. And that was the idea which allowed him to kind of organize all the practices and teachings in one system. This developed later in China, Korea, and Japan in interesting ways. The awakening of faith became very important later. And so the idea of original enlightenment and the Buddha nature of insentient beings, grasses and trees and mountains and rocks are also Buddha nature, was part of the Tendai tradition. I argue that it's not part of the original Tendai, but that's how it developed for most of East Asia. And then in Japan, this idea is taken to the extreme of everyone is enlightened just as they are. And there were a few people in Japanese Buddhism, Tendai monk named Hochibo Shoshin, who argued against this, saying, well, if we're okay as we are, then there's no meaning to practice. There's no incentive to practice. So he is critical of that. So it's not like it was accepted universally. But I think it's safe to say that idea of Buddha nature as everyone has Buddha nature and they're already okay, enlightened as they are, became a kind of unspoken assumption to most of Japanese Buddhism.
So one of the interesting ideas, kind of the corollary that becomes very important in East Asia to, you know, the idea of original enlightenment, original awakening Buddha nature, the primordially pure nature, a good nature of our existence, is that for most of East Asia, the idea that we are in the final period of the Dharma, and however you want to count the years, and there's a billion controversies about when it begins and whatnot, but the idea is that, you know, somehow or another, we're kind of precluded by nature from practice or from awakening, right? So we kind of need to end up in the pure land of Amida, and because the pure land is not in samsara, right? The art of samsara, there we can perfect our Buddhahood. But so for a lot of East Asia, though, how to balance the notion of, you know, primordially awakened and yet factually stupid and deluded and degenerate becomes an issue. And it's kind of interesting because For all of East Asia, the fact that we're living in the final period of the Dharma, and we are by definition, you know, pratakshana or tadanobompu, right, just ordinary beings who are outside the Dharma and incapable of practice, doesn't close off avenues of practice. It opens up new avenues. So the whole Pure Land tradition, which, you know, together with Chan, pretty much is what's going on in much of East Asia, together with the somewhat later Japanese Nichiren tradition, is how to deal with the fact that, you know, Buddha nature is interesting, but yeah, here we are, you know. I'm not going to sit in a cave for 3 years or 30 years. I'm not going to be under the Bodhi tree until I become a Buddha. That's not going to happen for me. Now what do I do? So, you know, kind of how to work those two things are interesting. And as I said, it didn't end people's practice. It didn't preclude them. It kind of opened up new avenues. We have to figure out something for us to do. But it's not going to be the heroic person, you know, that's going to achieve Buddhahood and save all sentient beings. And for me, you know, now, I mean, I'm teaching at an elite liberal arts institution. We have to have little, you know, psychological breathing things for our students, because perfectionism is an issue, you know. And, you know, it's like, okay, you might get an A- someday, you know, don't need Prozac, it's all right, right? And we teach this, you know, and the whole idea of perfectionism. And so sometimes I stop and I say to my students, so, you know, what about this Buddha stuff, you know? I mean, you're going to become a Buddha, fully awakened, maybe perhaps even omniscient, perfectly ethical, and save all suffering beings? Yeah, it's kind of megalomaniacal, perhaps, and you might be setting yourself up for a great lot of need for therapy. So in East Asia, that idea that we are ordinary worldlings, yet we have this Buddha nature, becomes a big issue, whether it's Dogen going to China, wondering about why do I have to practice if I'm already originally awakened, to the other Pure Land traditions that are just trying to, like, what do we do? I'm a householder. I yell at my kids. You know, I say I'm not going to be snarky, and then I'm snarky immediately, right? You know, what do we do now? So that's another interesting aspect of the Buddha nature story, is what do we real beings do? I mean, what do we? That's a wonderful upaya, perhaps. But I'm living here, and I've got kids that piss me off, right?
So can we ask each of you for a definition of Buddha nature?
Can I get one of the texts from off the table?
Woof.
A teaching in need of interpretation.
Buddha nature in what sense? As Tathagatagarbha, as original enlightenment, as Ekayana, as the potential for... There's no single definition, right? I can't define it. I can give various definitions that have been provided to by the tradition, but that's an ineffable question. But my favorite answer is, I didn't have a chance to talk about this upstairs, but is... my focus is on Juri Dientai of 6th century China, and his analysis of Buddha nature. And Buddha nature became very important in the later Tendai tradition. And it appears in Juri's work in the 6th century, but it doesn't have the central kind of focus on that term that it takes on in the later tradition. But he, like with most terms, he gives a threefold analysis of it. There's Buddha nature as the way things are. There's Buddha nature as the wisdom of awareness. And there's Buddha wisdom as the practice which leads to the wisdom which sees reality as it is. And without those three factors, the Buddha nature, you can't talk about Buddha nature without those three aspects. So if you have Buddha nature without the practice, I mean, it doesn't make sense. So that's where the practice comes in, I think. And I like that formulation. It provides a way to understand Buddha nature without making it a kind of something that exists inside. It's a potential, but it is a potential that has to be realized through specific practices. And so...
It's a teaching in need of interpretation, or a heresy, your choice. That's my opinion.
That's a classification. What about a definition?
That's a classification, not a definition. Splitting hairs. Or
maybe you could tell us why it's in need of interpretation.
If it quacks like a duck, it's a duck, right? I mean, this is why people have argued about it for so long, right? I mean, all of the language that is used in all of the different texts, as Paul said, I mean, there's a lot of different definitions, and Buddha nature is not the same as the Tathagatagarbha, and that's not the same as Honkaku, original awakening. These are all different concepts, and in the different texts, they're all kind of defined differently. But if in the end we're talking about some way in which we already are a fully realized cognizant Buddha, then okay, that's one definition.
Well, maybe it's like the definition of a second marriage. It's the triumph of hope over reality.
He's much better at this than I am.